The bus had already gone, of course, and that meant a 2-mile walk home. Pete didn't mind. He was still glowing from Mr. Ricker's praise, and he had a lot to think about. Rothstein's unpublished works, mostly. The short stories were uneven, he thought, only a few of them really good, and the poems he'd tried to write were, in Pete's humble opinion, pretty lame. But those last two Jimmy Gold novels were, well, gold. Judging by the evidence scattered through them, Pete guessed the last one, where Jimmy raises a burning flag at a Washington peace rally, had been finished around 1973 because Nixon was still president when the story ended. That Rothstein had never published the final Gold books, plus yet another novel, this one about the Civil War, blew Pete's mind. They were so good. Pete took only one moleskin at a time down from the attic, reading them with his door closed and an ear cocked for unexpected company when there were other members of his family in the house. He always kept another book handy, and if he heard approaching footsteps, he would slide the notebook under his mattress and pick up the spare. The only time he'd been caught was by Tina, who had the unfortunate habit of walking around in her socked feet. "What's that?" she'd asked from the doorway. "None of your beeswax," he had replied, slipping the notebook under his pillow. "And if you say anything to Mom or Dad, you're in trouble with me." "Is it porno?"
"No!"
Although Mr. Rothstein could write some pretty racy scenes, especially for an old guy. For instance, the one where Jimmy and these two hippie chicks.
"Then why don't you want me to see it?"
"Because it's private." Her eyes lit up.
"Is it yours? Are you writing a book?"
"Maybe. So what if I am?"
"I think that's cool. What's it about?"
"Bugs having sex on the moon?" She giggled.
"I thought you said it wasn't porno.
Can I read it when you're done?"
"We'll see. Just keep your trap shut, okay?"
She had agreed. And one thing you could say for teens, she rarely broke a promise. That had been 2 years ago, and Pete was sure she'd forgotten all about it.
Billy Weber came rolling up on a gleaming 10-speed. "Hey, Sobbers!"
Like almost everyone else, Mr. Ricker was an exception. Billy pronounced it Sobbers instead of Saubers. But what the hell? It was sort of a dipshit name, however you said it.
"What you doing this summer?"
"Working at the Garner Street Lib."
"Still?"
"I talked them into it 20 hours a week."
"Fuck, man, you're too young to be a wage slave."
"I don't mind," Pete said, which was the truth. The Lib meant free computer time, among the other perks, with no one looking over your shoulder. "What about you?"
"Going to our summer place up in Maine, China Lake. Many cute girls in bikinis, man, and the ones from Massachusetts know what to do."
"Then maybe they can show you," Pete thought snidely, but when Billy held out his palm, Pete slapped him 5 and watched him go with mild envy. 10-speed bike under his ass, expensive Nike kicks on his feet, summer place in Maine. It seemed that some people had already caught up from the bad time, or maybe the bad time had missed them completely. Not so with the Saubers family. They were doing okay, but
there must be more money, the house had whispered in the Lawrence story. There must be more money.
And honey, that was resonance.
Could the notebooks be turned into money? Was there a way?
Pete didn't even like to think about giving them up, but at the same time, he recognized how wrong it was to keep them hidden away in the attic. Rothstein's work, especially the last two Jimmy Gold books, deserved to be shared with the world. They would remake Rothstein's reputation, Pete was sure of that. But his rep still wasn't that bad, and besides, it wasn't the important part. People would like them. That was the important part. Love them, if they were like Pete. Only handwritten manuscripts weren't like untraceable 20s and 50s. Pete would be caught, and he might go to jail. He wasn't sure exactly what crime he could be charged with, not receiving stolen property, surely because he hadn't received it, only found it, but he was positive that trying to sell what wasn't yours had to be some kind of crime. Donating the notebooks to Rothstein's alma mater seemed like a possible answer. Only he'd have to do it anonymously, or it would all come out and his parents would discover that their son had been supporting them with a murdered man's stolen money. Besides, for an anonymous donation, you got zilch. Although he hadn't written about Rothstein's murder in his term paper, Pete had read all about it, mostly in the computer room at the library. He knew that Rothstein had been shot execution style. He knew that the cops had found enough different tracks in the dooryard to believe 2, 3, or even 4 people had been involved, and that based on the size of those tracks, all were probably men. They also thought that 2 of the men had been killed at a New York rest area not long after. Margaret Brennan, the author's first wife, had been interviewed in Paris not long after the killing.
"Everyone talked about him in that provincial little town where he lived," she said. "What else did they have to talk about? Cows? Some farmer's new manure spreader? To the provincials, John was a big deal. They had the erroneous idea that writers make as much as corporate bankers and believed he had hundreds of thousands of dollars stashed away on that rundown farm of his. Someone from out of town heard the loose talk, that's all. Close-mouthed Yankees, my Irish Fanny. I blame the locals as much as the thugs who did it."
When asked about the possibility that Rothstein had squirreled away manuscripts as well as cash, Peggy Brennan had given what the interview called a cigarette-raspy chuckle.
"More rumors, darling. Johnny pulled back from the world for one reason and one reason only. He was burned out and too proud to admit it."
"Like you knew," Pete thought. "He probably divorced you because he got tired of that cigarette-raspy chuckle." There was plenty of speculation in the newspaper and magazine articles Pete had read, but he himself liked what Mr. Ricker called the Occam's razor principle. According to that, the simplest and most obvious answer was usually the right one. 3 men had broken in, and one of them had killed his partners so he could keep all the swag for himself. Pete had no idea why the guy had come to the city afterwards or why he'd buried the trunk, but one thing he was sure of, the surviving robber was never going to come back and get it. Pete's math skills weren't the strongest. It was why he needed that summer course to bone up, but you didn't have to be an Einstein to run simple numbers and assess certain possibilities. If the surviving robber had been 35 in 1978, which seemed like a fair estimate to Pete, he would have been 67 in 2010 when Pete found the trunk, and around 70 now. 70 was ancient. If he turned up looking for his loot, he'd probably do so on a walker. Pete smiled as he turned onto Sycamore Street. He thought there were 3 possibilities for why the surviving robber had never come back for his trunk, all equally likely. 1, he was in prison somewhere for some other crime. 2, he was dead. 3 was a combination of 1 and 2. He had died in prison. Whichever it was, Pete didn't think he had to worry about the guy. The notebooks, though, were a different story. About them he had plenty of worries. Sitting on them was like sitting on a bunch of beautiful stolen paintings you could never sell. Or a crate filled with dynamite. In September of 2013, almost exactly 35 years from the date of John Rothstein's murder, Pete tucked the last of the trunk money into an envelope addressed to his father. The final installment amounted to $340, and because he felt that hope which could never be realized was a cruel thing, he added a one-line note. "This is the last of it. I am sorry there's not more." He took a city bus to Birch Hill Mall, where there was a mailbox between Discount Electronics and the yogurt place. He looked around, making sure he wasn't observed, and kissed the envelope. Then he slipped it through the slot and walked away. He did it Jimmy Gold style, without looking back. A week or two after New Year's, Pete was in the kitchen making himself a peanut butter and jelly sandwich when he overheard his parents talking to Tina in the living room. It was about Chapel Ridge. "I thought maybe we could afford it," his dad was saying. "If I gave you false hope, I'm just as sorry as can be, teens." "It's because the mystery money stopped coming," Tina said. "Right?" Mom said, "Partly, but not entirely. Dad tried for a bank loan, but they wouldn't give it to him. They went over his business records and did something." "A 2-year profit projection," Dad said. Some of the old post-accident bitterness crept into his voice. "Lots of compliments, because those are free." They said they might be able to make the loan in 2016 if the business grows by 5%. In the meantime, this goddamn polar vortex thing. We're way over your mom's budget on heating expenses. Everyone is, from Maine to Minnesota. I know that's no consolation, but there it is. Honey, we're so, so sorry, Mom said. Pete expected Tina to explode into a full-fledged tantrum. There were lots more of those as she approached the Big 13, but it didn't happen. She said she understood, and that Chapel Ridge was probably a snooty school anyway. Then she came out to the kitchen and asked Pete if he would make her a sandwich because his looked good. He did, and they went into the living room, and all four of them watched TV together and had some laughs over the Big Bang Theory. Later that night, though, he heard Tina crying behind the closed door of her room. It made him feel awful. He went into his own room, pulled one of the moleskins out from under his mattress, and began rereading The Runner Goes West. He was taking Mrs. Davis's creative writing course that semester, and although he got A's on his stories, he knew by February that he was never going to be a fiction writer. Although he was good with words, a thing he didn't need Mrs. Davis to tell him, although she often did, he just didn't possess that kind of creative spark. His chief interest was in reading fiction, in trying to analyze what he had read, fitting it into a larger pattern. He had gotten a taste for this kind of detective work while writing his paper on Rothstein. At the Garner Street Library, he hunted out one of the books Mr. Ricker had mentioned, Fiedler's Love and Death in the American Novel, and liked it so much that he bought his own copy in order to highlight certain passages and write in the margins. He wanted to major in English more than ever, and teach like Mr. Ricker, except maybe at a university instead of in high school, and at some point write a book like Mr. Fiedler's, getting into the faces of more traditional critics and questioning the established way those traditional critics looked at things. And yet, there had to be more money. Mr. Feldman, the guidance counselor, told him that getting a full boat scholarship to an Ivy League school was rather unlikely, and Pete knew even that was an exaggeration. He was just another white-bread high school kid from a so-so Midwestern school. A kid with a part-time library job and a few unglamorous extracurriculars like newspaper and yearbook. Even if he did manage to catch a boat, there was Tina to think about. She was basically trudging through her days, getting mostly B's and C's, and seemed more interested in makeup and shoes and pop music than school these days. She needed a change, a clean break. He was wise enough, even at not quite 17, to know that Chapel Ridge might not fix his little sister, but then again, it might. Especially since she wasn't broken. At least not yet. I need a plan, he thought, only that wasn't precisely what he needed. What he needed was a story. And although he was never going to be a great fiction writer like Mr. Rothstein or Mr. Lawrence, he was able to plot. That was what he had to do now. Only every plot stood on an idea, and on that score he kept coming up empty. He had begun to spend a lot of time at Water Street Books, where the coffee was cheap and even new paperbacks were 30% off. He went by one afternoon in March, on his way to his after-school job at the library, thinking he might pick up something by Joseph Conrad. In one of his few interviews, Rothstein had called Conrad the first great writer of the 20th century, even though his best work was written before 1900. Outside the bookstore, a long table had been set up beneath an awning. Spring cleaning, the sign said. Everything on this table 70% off. And below it, who knows what buried treasure you will find. This line was flanked by big yellow smiley faces to show it was a joke, but Pete didn't think it was funny. He finally had an idea. A week later, he stayed after school to talk to Mr. Ricker. Great to see you, Pete. Mr. Ricker was wearing a paisley shirt with billowy sleeves today, along with a psychedelic tie. Pete thought the combination said quite a lot about why the Love and Peace generation had collapsed. Mrs. Davis says great things about you. She's cool, Pete said. I'm learning a lot. Actually, he wasn't. and he didn't think anyone else in her class was either. She was nice enough, and quite often had interesting things to say, but Pete was coming to the conclusion that creative writing couldn't really be taught, only learned.
What can I do for you?
Remember when you were talking about how valuable a handwritten Shakespeare manuscript would be? Mr. Ricker grinned. I always talk about that during a midweek class when things get dozy. There's nothing like a little avarice to perk kids up.
Why? Have you found a folio, Malvolio?
Pete smiled politely. No, but when we were visiting my Uncle Phil in Cleveland during February vacation, I went out to his garage and found a whole bunch of old books. Most of them were about Tom Swift. He was this kid inventor.
I remember Tom and his friend Ned Newton well, Mr. Ricker said. Tom Swift and his motorcycle. Tom Swift and his wizard camera.
When I was a kid myself, we used to joke about Tom Swift and his electric grandmother. Pete renewed his polite smile. There were also a dozen or so about a girl detective named Trixie Belden and another one named Nancy Drew.
I believe I see where you're going with this, and I hate to disappoint you, but I must. Tom Swift, Nancy Drew, the Hardy Boys, Trixie Belden, all interesting relics of a bygone age and a wonderful yardstick to judge how much what is called YA fiction has changed in the last 80 years or so. But those books have little or no monetary value, even when found in excellent condition.
I know, Pete said. I checked it out later on Fine Books. That's a blog. But while I was looking those books over, Uncle Phil came out to the garage and said he had something else that might interest me even more, because I told him I was into John Rothstein. It was a signed hardback of The Runner. Not dedicated, just a flat signature. Uncle Phil said some guy named Al gave it to him because he owed my uncle $10 from a poker game. Uncle Phil said he'd had it for almost 50 years. I looked at the copyright page, and it's a first edition. Mr. Ricker had been rocked back in his chair, but now he sat down with a bang.
Whoa! You probably know that Rothstein didn't sign many autographs, right?
Yeah, Pete said. He called it defacing a perfectly good book.
Uh-huh. He was like Raymond Chandler that way. And you know signed volumes are worth more when it's just the signature? Sans dedication?
Yes, it says so in Fine Books.
A signed first of Rothstein's most famous book probably would be worth money, Mr. Ricker considered. On second thought, strike the probably.
What kind of condition is it in?
Good, Pete said promptly. Some foxing on the inside cover and title pages all. You have been reading up on this stuff.
More since my uncle showed me the Rothstein.
I don't suppose you're in possession of this fabulous book, are you?
I've got something a lot better, Pete thought, if you only knew. Sometimes he felt the weight of that knowledge, and never more than today telling these lies. Necessary lies, he reminded himself.
I don't, but my uncle said he'd give it to me if I wanted it. I said I needed to think about it because he doesn't, you know.
He doesn't have any idea how much it might really be worth?
Yeah, but then I started wondering.
What?
Pete dug into his back pocket, took out a folded sheet of paper, and handed it to Mr. Ricker.
I went looking on the internet for book dealers here in town that buy and sell first editions, and I found these three. I know you're sort of a book collector yourself.
Not much. I can't afford serious collecting on my salary, but I've got a signed Theodore Retke that I intend to hand down to my children. The Waking. Very fine poems. Also a Vonnegut, but that's not worth so much. Unlike Rothstein, Father Kurt signed everything.
Anyway, I wondered if you knew any of these, and if you do, which one might be the best, if I decided to let him give me the book, and then, you know, sell it.
Mr. Ricker unfolded the sheet, glanced at it, then looked at Pete again. That gaze, both keen and sympathetic, made Pete feel uneasy. This might have been a bad idea. He really wasn't much good at fiction, but he was in it now and would have to plow through somehow.
As it happens, I know all of them. But geez, kiddo,
I also know how much Rothstein means to you, and not just from your paper last year. Annie Davis says you bring him up often in creative writing, claims the Gold Trilogy is your Bible. Pete supposed this was true, but he hadn't realized how blabby he'd been until now. He resolved to stop talking about Rothstein so much. It might be dangerous. People might think back and remember if... It's good to have literary heroes, Pete, especially if you plan to major in English when you get to college. Rothstein is yours, at least for now, and that book could be the beginning of your own library. Are you sure you want to sell it? Pete could answer this question with fair honesty, even though it wasn't really a signed book he was talking about. Pretty sure, yeah. Things have been a little tough at home. I know what happened to your father at City Center, and I'm sorry as hell. At least they caught the psycho before he could do any more damage. Dad's better now, and both he and my mom are working again. Only I'm probably going to need money for college, see? I understand. But that's not the biggest thing, at least not now. My sister wants to go to Chapel Ridge, and my parents told her she couldn't, at least not this coming year. They can't quite swing it. Close, but no cigar. And I think she needs a place like that. She's kind of, I don't know, lagging. Mr. Ricker, who had undoubtedly known lots of students who were lagging, nodded gravely. But if Tina could get in with a bunch of strivers, especially this one girl, Barbara Robinson, she used to know from when we lived on the West Side, things might turn around. It's good of you to think of her future, Pete. Noble, even. Pete had never thought of himself as noble. The idea made him blink. Perhaps seeing his embarrassment, Mr. Ricker turned his attention to the list again. Okay. Grissom Books would have been your best bet when Teddy Grissom was still alive, but his son runs the shop now, and he's a bit of a tightwad. Honest, but close with a buck. He'd say it's the times, but it's also his nature. Okay. I assume you've checked on the net to find out how much a signed first edition runner in good condition is valued at? Yeah. 2,000 or 3,000. Not enough for a year at Chapel Ridge, but a start. What my dad calls earnest money. Mr. Ricker nodded. That sounds about right. Teddy Jr. would start you at 800. You might get him up to a grand, but if you kept pushing, he'd get his back up and tell you to take a hike. This next one, by the book, is Buddy Franklin's shop. He's also okay. By which I mean honest, but Buddy doesn't have much interest in 20th century fiction. His big deal is selling old maps and 17th century atlases to rich guys in Branson Park and Sugar Heights. But if you could talk Buddy into valuing the book, then go to Teddy Jr. at Grissom, you might get 1,200. I'm not saying you would, I'm just saying it's possible. What about Andrew Halliday rare editions? Mr. Ricker frowned. I'd steer clear of Halliday. He's got a little shop on Lacemaker Lane and that walking mall off Lower Main Street. Not much wider than an Amtrak car, but damn near a block long. Seems to do quite well, but there's an odor about him. I've heard it said he's not too picky about the provenance of certain items. Do you know what that is? The line of ownership. Right. Ending with a piece of paper that says you legally own what you're trying to sell. The only thing I know for sure is that about 15 years ago, Halliday sold a proof copy of James Agee's Let Us Now Praise Famous Men, and it turned out to have been stolen from the estate of Brooke Astor. She was a rich old biddy from New York with a larcenous business manager. Halliday showed a receipt, and his story of how he came by the book was credible, so the investigation was dropped. But receipts can be forged, you know. I'd steer clear of him. Thanks, Mr. Ricker, Pete said, thinking that if he went ahead with this, Andrew Halliday Rare Editions would be his first stop. But he would have to be very, very careful. And if Mr. Halliday wouldn't do a cash deal, that would mean no deal. Plus, under no circumstances could he know Pete's name. A disguise might be in order, although it wouldn't do to go overboard on that. You're welcome, Pete. But if I said I felt good about this, I'd be lying. Pete could relate. He didn't feel so good about it himself. He was still mulling his options a month later, and had almost come to the conclusion that trying to sell even one of the notebooks would be too much risk for too little reward. If it went to a private collector, like the ones he had sometimes read about, who bought valuable paintings to hang in secret rooms where only they could look at them, it would be okay, but he couldn't be sure that would happen. He was leaning more and more to the idea of donating them anonymously, maybe mailing them to the New York University Library. The curator of a place like that would understand the value of them, no doubt. But doing that would be a little more public than Pete liked to think about, not at all like dropping the letters with the money inside them into anonymous street corner mailboxes. What if someone remembered him at the post office? Then on a rainy night in late April of 2014, Tina came to his room again. Mrs. Beasley was long gone, and the footy pajamas had been replaced by an oversized Cleveland Browns football jersey, but to Pete, she looked very much like the worried girl who had asked during the era of bad feelings if their mother and father were going to get divorced. Her hair was in pigtails, and with her face cleansed of the little makeup Mom let her wear, Pete had an idea she put on fresh layers when she got to school, she looked closer to 10 than going on 13. He thought, teens is almost a teen. It was hard to believe. Can I come in for a minute?
Sure.
He was lying on his bed reading a novel by Philip Roth called When She Was Good. Tina sat on his desk chair, pulling her jersey nightshirt down over her shins and blowing a few errant hairs from her forehead where a faint scattering of acne had appeared.
Something on your mind? Pete asked.
Yeah.
But she didn't go on. He wrinkled his nose at her.
Go on. Spill it.
Some boy you've been crushing on told you to buzz off?
You sent that money, she said. Didn't you?
Pete stared at her, flabbergasted. He tried to speak and couldn't. He tried to persuade himself she hadn't said what she'd said and couldn't do that either. She nodded as if he had admitted it.
Yeah, you did. It's all over your face.
It didn't come from me, teens. You just took me by surprise. Where would I get money like that?
I don't know, but I remember the night you asked me what I'd do if I found a buried treasure.
I did? Thinking, you were half asleep. You can't remember that.
Doubloons, you said. Coins from olden days. I said I'd give it to Dad and Mom so they wouldn't fight anymore, and that's just what you did. Only it wasn't pirate treasure. It was regular money.
Pete put his book aside. Don't you go telling them that. They might actually believe you. She looked at him solemnly.
I never would, but I need to ask you. Is it really all gone?
The note in the last envelope said it was, Pete replied cautiously. And there hasn't been any more since, so I guess so. She sighed.
Yeah, what I figured, but I had to ask.
She got up to go.
Tina?
What?
I'm really sorry about Chapel Ridge and all. I wish the money wasn't gone.
She sat down again.
I'll keep your secret if you keep one Mom and I have, okay?
Okay.
Last November, she took me to Chap. That's what the girls call it for one of their tour days. She didn't want Dad to know because she thought he'd be mad. But back then, she thought they maybe could afford it, especially if I got a need scholarship. Do you know what that is?
Pete nodded.
Only the money hadn't stopped coming then, and it was before all the snow and weird cold weather in December and January. We saw some of the classrooms and the science labs. There's like a jillion computers. We also saw the gym, which is humongous, and the showers. They have private changing booths, too, not just cattle stalls like at Northfield. At least they do for the girls. Guess who my tour group had for a guide?
Barbara Robinson.
She smiled. It was great to see her again.
Then the smile faded.
She said hello and gave me a hug and asked how everyone was, but I could tell she hardly remembered me. Why would she, right? Did you know her and Hilda and Betsy and a couple of other girls from back then were at the Round Here concert? The one the guy who ran over Dad tried to blow up?
Yeah. Pete also knew that Barbara Robinson's big brother had played a part in saving Barbara and Barbara's friends and maybe thousands of others. He'd gotten a medal or a key to the city or something.
That was real heroism, not sneaking around and mailing stolen money to your parents.
Did you know I was invited to go with them that night?
What? No.
Tina nodded. I said I couldn't because I was sick, but I wasn't. It was because Mom said they couldn't afford to buy me a ticket. We moved a couple of months later.
Jesus, how about that, huh?
Yeah, I missed all the excitement.
So, how was the school tour?
Good, but not great or anything. I'll be fine at Northfield. Hey, once they find out I'm your sister, they'll probably give me a free ride, honor roll boy.
Pete suddenly felt sad, almost like crying. It was the sweetness that had always been part of Tina's nature, combined with that ugly scatter of pimples on her forehead. He wondered if she got teased about those. If she didn't yet, she would. He held out his arms. Come here. She did, and he gave her a strong hug. Then he held her by the shoulders and looked at her sternly. But that money, it wasn't me.
Uh-huh. Okay. So was that notebook you were reading stuck in with the money? I bet it was,
she giggled.
You looked so guilty that night when I walked in on you.
He rolled his eyes. Go to bed, short stuff.
Okay.
At the door, she turned back.
I like those private changing booths, though. And something else, want to know? You'll think it's weird.
Go ahead, lay it on me.
The kids wear uniforms. For the girls, it's gray skirts with white blouses and white knee socks. There are also sweaters, if you want. Some gray like the skirts and some this pretty dark red. Hunter red, they call it, Barbara said.
Uniforms, Pete said, bemused. You like the idea of uniforms.
Knew you'd think it was weird, because boys don't know how girls are. Girls can be mean if you're wearing the wrong clothes, or even if you wear the right ones too much. You can wear different blouses or your sneakers on Tuesdays and Thursdays. You can do different things with your hair, but pretty soon they, the mean girls, figure out you've only got 3 jumpers and 6 good school skirts. Then they say stuff. But when everyone wears the same thing every day, except maybe the sweater's a different color,
she blew back those few errant strands again.
Boys don't have the same problem.
I actually do get it, Pete said.
Anyway, Mom's going to teach me how to make my own clothes, then I'll have more. Simplicity. Butterick. Also, I've got friends. Plenty of them.
Ellen, for instance.
Ellen's okay.
And headed for a rewarding job as a waitress or a drive-through girl after high school, Pete thought, but did not say. If she doesn't get pregnant at 16, that is.
I just wanted to tell you not to worry if you were.
I wasn't, Pete said. I know you'll be fine. And it wasn't me who sent the money. Honest. She gave him a smile, both sad and complicit, that made her look like anything but a little girl.
Okay, gotcha.
She left, closing the door gently behind her. Pete lay awake for a long time that night. Not long after, he made the biggest mistake of his life. 1979 through 2014. Morris Randolph Bellamy was sentenced to life in prison on January 11th, 1979. And for a brief time, things went fast before they went slow. And slow. And slow. His intake at Waynesville State Prison was completed by 6 p.m. the day of his sentencing. His cellmate, a convicted murderer named Roy Allgood, raped him for the first time 45 minutes after lights out.
Hold still and don't you shit on my cock, young man, he whispered in Morris's ear. If you do that, I'll cut your nose. You'll look like a pig been bit by an alligator.
Morris, who had been raped before, held still, biting his forearm to keep from screaming. He thought of Jimmy Gold, as Jimmy had been before he started chasing the golden buck, when he had still been an authentic hero. He thought of Harold Feynman, Jimmy's high school friend. Morris had never had a high school friend himself,
saying that all good things must end, which implied the converse was also true. Bad things must end, too. This particular bad thing went on for a long time, and while it did, Morris repeated Jimmy's mantra from the runner over and over in his mind. Shit don't mean shit. Shit don't mean shit. Shit don't mean shit. It helped. A little. In the weeks that followed, he was ass-raped by All Good on some nights and mouth-raped on others. On the whole, he preferred taking it up the ass where there were no taste buds. Either way, he thought that Cora Ann Hooper, the woman he had so foolishly attacked while in a blackout, was getting what she would probably have considered perfect justice. On the other hand, she'd only had to endure an unwanted invader once. There was a clothing factory attached to Waynesville. The factory made jeans and the kind of shirts workmen wore. On his fifth day in the dye house, one of All Good's friends took him by the wrist, led Morris around the number 3 blue vat, and told him to unbuckle his pants.
"You just hold still and let me do the rest," he said. When he was finished, he said, "I ain't a fag or anything, but I gotta get along same as anyone. Tell anyone I'm a fag and I'll fucking kill you."
"I won't," Morris said. "Shit don't mean shit," he told himself. "Shit don't mean shit." One day in mid-March of 1979, a Hell's Angel type with tattooed slabs of muscle strolled up to Morris in the exercise yard.
"Can you rat?" this fella said with an unmistakable deep South accent. "I hear you can rat."
"Yes, I can write," Morris said. He saw All Good approach, notice who was walking beside Morris, and sheer off toward the basketball court at the far end of the yard.
"I'm Warren Duckworth. Most folks call me Duck."
"I'm Morris Bell."
"I know who you are. Write pretty well, do you?"
"Yes," Morris spoke with no hesitation or false modesty. The way Roy Allgood had suddenly found another place to be wasn't lost on him.
"Could you write a letter to my wife if I sort of tell you what to say? Only put it in, like, better words."
"I could do that, and I will, but I've got a little problem."
"I know what your problem is," his new acquaintance said. "You write my wife a letter that'll make her happy. Maybe stop her divorce talk. You ain't gonna have no more trouble with that skinny bitch boy in your house."
"I'm the skinny bitch boy in my house," Morris thought, but he felt the tiniest glimmer of hope. "Sir, I'm going to write your wife the prettiest letter she ever got in her life." Looking at Duckworth's huge arms, he thought of something he'd seen on a nature program. There was a kind of bird that lived in the mouths of crocodiles, granted survival on a day-to-day basis by pecking bits of food out of reptiles' jaws. Morris thought that kind of bird probably had a pretty good deal. "I'd need some paper." Thinking of the reformatory where 5 lousy sheets of Blue Horse was all you ever got, paper with big spots of pulp floating in it like precancerous moles.
"I'll get you paper, all you want. You just write that letter, and at the end say every word came from my mouth, and you just wrote it down."
"Okay, tell me what would make her most happy to hear." Duck considered, then brightened.
"That she throws a fine fuck?"
"She'll know that already." It was Morris's turn to consider. "What part of her does she say she'd change if she could?" Duck's frown deepened.
"I don't know. She always says her ass is too big. But she can't say that. It'll make things worse instead of better."
"No, what I'll write is how much you love to put your hands on it and squeeze it." Duck was smiling now.
"Better watch out, or I'll be raping you myself."
"What's her favorite dress? Does she have one?"
"Yeah, a green one. It's silk. Her ma gave it to her last year, just before I went up. She wears that one when we go out dancing."
He looked down at the ground.
"She better not be dancing now, but she might be. I know that. Maybe I can't write much more than my own fucking name, but I ain't no stoop."
"I could write how much you like to squeeze her bottom when she's wearing that green dress. How's that? I could say thinking of that gets you hot." Duck looked at Morris with an expression that was utterly foreign to Morris's Waynesville experience. It was respect.
Say, that's not bad.
Morris was still working on it. Sex wasn't all women thought about when they thought about men. Sex wasn't romance. What color is her hair?
Well, right now, I don't know. She's what you call a brownette when there ain't no dye in it.
Brown didn't sing, at least not to Morris, but there were ways you could skate around stuff like that. It occurred to him that this was very much like selling a product in an ad agency and pushed the idea away. Survival was survival. He said, I'll write how much you like to see the sun shining in her hair, especially in the morning. Duck didn't reply. He was staring at Morris with his bushy eyebrows furrowed together. What? No good?
Duck seized Morris's arm, and for one terrible moment, Morris was sure he was going to break it like a dead branch. Hate was tattooed on the fingers of the big man's knuckles. Duck breathed. It's like poetry. I'll get you the paper tomorrow. There's lots in the library.
That night, when Morris returned to the cell block after a 3-to-9 shift spent blue dime, his house was empty. Rolf Venziano in the next cell told Morris that Roy Allgood had been taken to the infirmary. When Allgood returned the next day, both his eyes were black and his nose had been splinted. He looked at Morris from his bunk, then rolled over and faced the wall. Warren Duckworth was Morris's first client. Over the next 36 years, he had many. Sometimes when he couldn't sleep, lying on his back in his cell, by the early 90s he had a single complete with a shelf of well-thumbed books. Morris would soothe himself by remembering his discovery of Jimmy Gold. That had been a shaft of bright sunlight in the confused and angry darkness of his adolescence. By then his parents had been fighting all the time. And although he had grown to heartily dislike both of them, his mother had the better armor against the world, and so he adopted her sarcastic curl of a smile and the superior debunking attitude that went with it. Except for English, where he got A's when he wanted to, he was a straight C student. This drove Anita Bellamy into report card-waving frenzies. He had no friends, but plenty of enemies. 3 times he suffered beatings. 2 were administered by boys who just didn't like his general attitude, but 1 boy had a more specific issue. This was a hulking senior football player named Pete Womack, who didn't care for the way Morris was checking out his girlfriend one lunch period in the cafeteria.
"What are you looking at, rat face?" Womack inquired as the tables around Morris's solitary position grew silent.
"Her," Morris said.
He was frightened. And when clear-headed, fright usually imposed at least a modicum of restraint on his behavior, but he had never been able to resist an audience.
"Well, you want to quit it," Womack said rather lamely, giving him a chance. Perhaps Pete Womack was aware that he was 6'2 and 220, while the skinny red-lipped piece of freshman shit sitting by himself was 5'7 and maybe 140 soaking wet. He might also have been aware that those watching, including his clearly embarrassed girlfriend, would take note of this disparity.
"If she doesn't want to be looked at," Morris said, "why does she dress like that?"
Morris considered this a compliment, of the left-handed variety, granted, but Womack felt differently. He ran around the table, fists raised. Morris got in a single punch, but it was a good one, blacking Womack's eye. Of course, after that he got his shit handed to him, and most righteously. But that one punch was a revelation. He would fight. It was good to know. Both boys were suspended, and that night Morris got a 20-minute lecture on passive resistance from his mother, along with the acid observation that fighting in cafeteria was generally not the sort of extracurricular activity the finer colleges looked for on the applications of prospective enrollees. Behind her, his father raised his martini glass and dropped him a wink. It suggested that even though George Bellamy mostly resided beneath his wife's thumb and thin smile, he would also fight under certain circumstances. But running was still dear old Dad's default position, and during the second semester of Morris's freshman year at Northfield, Georgie Porgy ran right out of the marriage, pausing only to clean out what was left in the Bellamy bank account.
the investments of which he had boasted either didn't exist or had gone tits up. Anita Bellamy was left with a stack of bills and a rebellious 14-year-old son. Only two assets remained following her husband's departure to parts unknown. One was the framed Pulitzer nomination for that book of hers. The other was the house where Morris had grown up, situated in the nicer section of the North Side. It was mortgage-free because she had steadfastly refused to co-sign the bank papers her husband brought home, for once immune to his rhapsodizing about an investment opportunity that was absolutely not to be missed. She sold it after he was gone, and they moved to Sycamore Street. A come-down, she admitted to Morris during the summer between his freshman and sophomore years. But the financial reservoir will refill. At least the neighborhood is white. She paused, replaying that remark, and added, not that I'm prejudiced. No, Ma, Morris said. Who'd ever believe that? Ordinarily, she hated being called Ma and said so, but on that day she kept still, which made it a good day. It was always a good day when he got in a poke at her. There were so few opportunities. During the early 70s, book reports were still a requirement in sophomore English at Northfield. The students were given a mimeographed list of approved books to choose from. Most looked like dreck to Morris, and as usual, he wasn't shy about saying so. Look, he cried from his spot in the back row, 40 flavors of American oatmeal. Some of the kids laughed. He could make them laugh, and although he couldn't make them like him, that was absolutely okay. They were dead-enders headed for dead-end marriages and dead-end jobs. They would raise dead-end kids and dandle dead-end grandkids before coming to their own dead-ends in dead-end hospitals and nursing homes, rocketing off into darkness, believing they had lived the American dream, and Jesus would meet them at the gates of heaven with the welcome wagon. Morris was meant for better things. He just didn't know what they were. Miss Todd, then about the age Morris would be when he and his cohorts broke into John Rothstein's house, asked him to stay after class. Morris lounged, splay-legged, at his desk as the other kids went out, expecting Todd to write him a detention slip. It would not be his first for mouthing off in class, but it would be his first in an English class, and he was sort of sorry about that. A vague thought occurred to him in his father's voice. You're burning too many bridges, Maury, and was gone like a wisp of steam. Instead of giving him a detention, Miss Todd, not exactly fair of face but with a holy shit body, reached into her bulging book bag and brought out a paperback with a red cover. Sketched on it in yellow was a boy lounging against a brick wall and smoking a cigarette. Above him was the title, The Runner.
You never miss a chance to be a smartass, do you?
Miss Todd asked. She sat on the desk next to him. Her skirt was short, her thighs long, her hose shimmery. Morris said nothing.
In this case, I saw it coming, which is why I brought this book today. It's a good news, bad news thing, my know-it-all friend. You don't get detention, but you don't get to choose either. You get to read this and only this. It's not on the school board's approved list, and I suppose I could get in trouble for giving it to you, but I'm counting on your better nature, which I like to believe is in there somewhere, minuscule though it may be.
Morris glanced at the book, then looked over it at Miss Todd's legs, making no attempt to disguise his interest. She saw the direction of his gaze and smiled. For a moment, Morris glimpsed a whole future for them, most of it spent in bed. He had heard of such things actually happening. Yummy teacher seeks teenage boy for extracurricular lessons in sex education. This fantasy balloon lasted perhaps 2 seconds.
She popped it with her smile still in place.
You and Jimmy Gold will get along. He's a sarcastic, self-hating little shit. A lot like you.
She stood up. Her skirt fell back into place 2 inches above her knees.
Good luck with your book report, and the next time you peek up a woman's skirt, you might remember something Mark Twain said. Any idler in need of a haircut can look.
Morris slunk from the classroom with his face burning. For once, not just put in his place, but rammed into it and hammered flat.
He had an urge to chuck the paper back down a sewer drain as soon as he got off the bus on the corner of Sycamore and Elm, but held on to it. Not because he was afraid of detention or suspension, though. How could she do anything to him when the book wasn't on the approved list? He held on to it because of the boy on the cover. The boy looking through a drift of cigarette smoke with a kind of weary insolence.
He's a sarcastic, self-hating little shit. A lot like you.
His mother wasn't home and wouldn't be back until after 10. She was teaching adult education classes at City College to make extra money. Morris knew she loathed those classes, believing they were far beneath her skill set, and that was just fine with him. Sit on it, Ma, he thought. Sit on it and spin. The freezer was stocked with TV dinners. He picked one at random and shoved it in the oven, thinking he'd read until it was done. After supper, he might go upstairs, grab one of his father's Playboys from under the bed, my inheritance from the old man, he sometimes thought, and choke the chicken for a while. He neglected to set the stove timer, and it was the stench of burning beef stew that roused him from the book a full 90 minutes later. He had read the first 100 pages, no longer in this shitty little post-war tract home deep in the tree streets, but wandering the streets of New York City with Jimmy Gold. Like a boy in a dream, Morris went to the kitchen, donned oven gloves, removed the congealed mass from the oven, tossed it in the trash, and went back to the runner. I'll have to read it again, he thought. He felt as if he might be running a mild fever. And with a marker. There's so much to underline and remember. So much. For readers, one of life's most electrifying discoveries is that they are readers. Not just capable of doing it, which Morris already knew, but in love with it. Hopelessly. Head over heels. The first book that does that is never forgotten, and each page seems to bring a fresh revelation, one that burns and exalts. Yes, that's how it is. Yes, I saw that too. And of course, that's what I think. That's what I feel. Morris wrote a 10-page book report on the runner. It came back from Miss Todd with an A+ and a single comment. I knew you'd dig it. He wanted to tell her it wasn't digging. It was loving. True loving. And true love would never die. The runner sees action was every bit as good as the runner, only instead of being a stranger in New York City, Jimmy was now a stranger in Europe, fighting his way across Germany, watching his friends die, and finally staring with a blankness beyond horror through the barbed wire at one of the concentration camps. The wandering skeletal survivors confirmed what Jimmy had suspected for years, Rothstein wrote. It was all a mistake. Using a stencil kit, Morris copied this line in Roman Gothic print and thumbtacked it to the door of his room, the one that would later be occupied by a boy named Peter Salbers. His mother saw it hanging there, smiled her sarcastic curl of a smile, and said nothing, at least not then. Their argument over the Gold Trilogy came 2 years later, after she had raced through the books herself. That argument resulted in Morris getting drunk. Getting drunk resulted in breaking and entering and common assault. These crimes resulted in 9 months at Riverview Youth Detention Center. But before all that came, the runner slows down, which Morris read with increasing horror. Jimmy got married to a nice girl. Jimmy got a job in advertising. Jimmy began putting on weight. Jimmy's wife got pregnant with the first of 3 little Golds, and they moved to the suburbs. Jimmy made friends there. He and his wife threw backyard barbecue parties. Jimmy presided over the grill wearing an apron that said, "The chef is always right." Jimmy cheated on his wife, and his wife cheated right back. Jimmy took Alka-Seltzer for his acid indigestion and something called Milltown for his hangovers. Most of all, Jimmy pursued the golden buck. Morris read these terrible developments with ever-increasing dismay and growing rage. He supposed he felt the way his mother had when she discovered that her husband, whom she had believed comfortably under her thumb,
had been cleaning out all the accounts even as he ran hither and yon, eagerly doing her bidding and never once raising a hand to slap that sarcastic curl of a smile off her overeducated face.
Morris kept hoping that Jimmy would wake up, that he would remember who he was, who he had been at least, and trash the stupid and empty life he was leading. Instead of that, the runner slows down, ended with Jimmy celebrating his most successful ad campaign ever. Does he do, for God's sake? And crowing, just wait until next year. In the detention center, Morris had been required to see a shrink once a week. The shrink's name was Curtis Larson. The boys called him Curd the Turd. Curd the Turd always ended their sessions by asking Morris the same question.
Whose fault is it that you're in here, Morris? Most boys, even the cataclysmically stupid ones, knew the right answer to that question. Morris did too, but refused to give it. My mother's, he said each time the question was asked. At their final session, shortly before the end of Morris's term, Curd the Turd folded his hands on his desk and looked at Morris for a long space of silent seconds. Morris knew Curd the Turd was waiting for him to drop his eyes. He refused to do it.
In my game, Curd the Turd finally said, there's a term for your response. It's called blame avoidance. Will you be back in here if you continue to practice blame avoidance? Almost certainly not. You'll be 18 in a few months, so the next time you hit the jackpot, and there will be a next time, you'll be tried as an adult. Unless, that is, you make a change. So for the last time, whose fault is it that you're in here?
My mother's, Morris said with no hesitation, because it wasn't blame avoidance. It was the truth. The logic was inarguable.
Between 15 and 17, Morris read the first two books of the Gold Trilogy obsessively, underlining and annotating. He reread The Runner Slows Down only once and had to force himself to finish. Every time he picked it up, a ball of lead formed in his gut because he knew what was going to happen. His resentment of Jimmy Gold's creator grew. For Rothstein to destroy Jimmy like that, to not even allow him to go out in a blaze of glory, but to live, to compromise and cut corners and believe that sleeping with the Amway-selling slut down the street meant he was still a rebel. Morris thought of writing Rothstein a letter asking, no, demanding that he explain himself. But he knew from the Time cover story that the son of a bitch didn't even read his fan mail, let alone answer it. As Ricky the Hippie would suggest to Pete Saubers years later, most young men and women who fall in love with the works of a particular writer, the Vonneguts, the Hesses, the Brodigans, and Tolkiens, eventually find new idols. Disenchanted as he was with The Runner Slows Down, this might have happened to Morris. Before it could, there came the argument with the bitch who was determined to spoil his life since she could no longer get her hooks into the man who had spoiled hers. Anita Bellamy, with her framed near-miss Pulitzer and her sprayed dome of dyed blonde hair and her sarcastic curl of a smile. During her February vacation in 1973, she raced through all three Jimmy Gold novels in a single day, and they were his copies, his private copies, filched from his bedroom shelf. They littered the coffee table when he came in. The runner sees action soaking up a condensation ring from her wine glass.
For one of the few times in his adolescent life, Morris was speechless.
Anita wasn't.
You've been talking about these for well over a year now, so I finally decided I had to see what all the excitement was about. She sipped her wine. And since I had the week off, I read them. I thought it would take longer than a day, but there's really not much content here, is there?
You... He choked for a moment. Then, you went in my room.
You've never raised an objection when I go in to change your sheets or when I return your clothes, all clean and folded. Perhaps you thought the laundry fairy did those little chores.
Those books are mine. They were on my special shelf. You had no right to take them.
I'll be happy to put them back. And don't worry,
I didn't disturb the magazines under your bed. I know boys need amusement.
He stepped forward on legs that felt like stilts and gathered up the paperbacks with hands that felt like hooks. The back cover of The Runner Sees Action was soaking from her goddamn glass, and he thought, if one volume of the trilogy had to get wet, why couldn't it have been The Runner Slows Down?
I'll admit they're interesting artifacts, she had begun speaking in her judicious lecture hall voice. If nothing else, they show the growth of a marginally talented writer. The first two are painfully jejun, of course, the way Tom Sawyer is jejun when compared to Huckleberry Finn. But the last one, although no Huck Finn, does show growth.
The last one sucks, Morris shouted.
You needn't raise your voice, Morris. You needn't roar. You can defend your position without doing that.
And here was that smile he hated, so thin and so sharp.
We're having a discussion.
I don't want to have a fucking discussion!
But we should have one, Anita cried, smiling. Since I've spent my day, I won't say wasted my day, trying to understand my self-centered and rather pretentiously intellectual son, who is currently carrying a C average in his classes.
She waited for him to respond. He didn't. There were traps everywhere. She could run rings around him when she wanted to, and right now she wanted to.
I noticed that the first two volumes are tattered, almost falling out of their bindings, nearly read to death. There are copious underlinings and notes, some of which show the budding, I won't say flowering, it can't really be called that, can it? At least not yet, of an acute critical mind. But the third one looks almost new, and there are no underlinings at all. You don't like what happened to him, do you? You don't care for your Jimmy once he, and by logical transference, the author, grew up.
He sold out! Morris's fists were clenched. His face was hot and throbbing as it had been after Womack tuned up on him that day in the calf with everyone watching. But Morris had gotten in that one good punch, and he wanted to get one in now. He needed to. Rothstein let him sell out. If you can't see that, you're stupid.
No, she said. The smile was gone now. She leaned forward, set her glass on the coffee table, looking at him steadily all the while. That's the core of your misunderstanding. A good novelist does not lead his characters. He follows them. A good novelist does not create events. He watches them happen and then writes down what he sees. A good novelist realizes he is a secretary, not God.
That wasn't Jimmy's character. Fucking Rothstein changed him. He made Jimmy into a joke. He made him into everyone.
Morris hated how weak that sounded, and he hated that his mother had baited him into defending a position that didn't need defending, that was self-evident to anyone with half a brain and any feelings at all.
Morris, very softly, once I wanted to be the female version of Jimmy, just as you want to be Jimmy now. Jimmy Gold, or someone like him, is the island of exile, where most teenagers go to wait until childhood becomes adulthood. What you need to see, what Rothstein finally saw, although it took him three books to do it, is that most of us become everyone. I certainly did. She looked around. Why else would we be living here on Sycamore Street?
Because you were stupid and let my father rob us blind.
She winced at that. A hit, a palpable hit, Morris exulted.
But then the sarcastic curl resurfaced, like a piece of paper charring in an ashtray.
I admit there's an element of truth in what you say, although you're unkind to task me with it. But have you asked yourself why he robbed us blind?
Morris was silent.
Because he refused to grow up. Your father is a pot-bellied Peter Pan who's found some girl half his age to play Tinkerbell in bed.
Put my books back or throw them in the trash, Morris said in a voice he barely recognized. To his horror, it sounded like his father's voice.
I don't care which. I'm getting out of here, and I'm not coming back.
Oh, I think you will, she said, and she was right about that. But it was almost a year before he did, and by then she no longer knew him, if she ever had. And you should read this third one a few more times, I think.
She had to raise her voice to say the rest because he was plunging down the hall in the grip of emotion so strong he was almost blind.
Find some pity. Mr. Rothstein did, and it's the last book's saving grace.
The slam of the front door cut her off. Morris stalked to the sidewalk with his head down, and when he reached it, he began to run. There was a strip mall with a liquor store in it 3 blocks away. When he got there, he sat on the bike rack outside Hobby Terrific and waited. The first two guys he spoke to refused his request. The second, with a smile, Morris longed to punch off his face. But the third was wearing thrift shop clothes and walking with a pronounced list to port. He agreed to buy Morris a pint for $2, or a quart for $5. Morris opted for the quart and began drinking it beside the stream running through the undeveloped land between Sycamore and Birch Streets. By then the sun was going down. He had no memory of making his way to Sugar Heights in the boosted car, but there was no doubt that once he was there, he'd gotten into what Curd the Turd liked to call a mega jackpot.
Whose fault is it that you're in here?
He supposed a little of the blame could go to the wino who'd bought an underage kid a quart of whiskey, but mostly it was his mother's fault. And one good thing had come of it. When he was sentenced, there had been no sign of that sarcastic curl of a smile. He had finally wiped it off her face.